Nasuna Oof closed her enormous eyes in a transport of delight. We brush each other's hair, and then, if you're really kinky, we open up and show each other our feelings, she whispered. Her breathing was getting heavy. But that's only if you're into the hardcore XXX stuff. Why? How do humans do it? Jones blinked. There were rules to a one-night stand. Protocols. Diplomatic procedures. And the most important one was not to shame the other guy for the way his rudder leaned. He always tried to be open and giving and create a good memory for everyone involved. Good memories rarely include being laughed out of the room. He said, pulling the modernist bronze and grey striped sheet over his naked and suddenly unaroused body. Same. Maybe a hug, too, if there's time, but mostly same. But Des had to admit, her hair was amazing. It was like brushing a snowbank. With every stroke, the smaragdin quivered and shook and made soft little moans like strumming a bass underwater. Whenever he hit a tangle, she gasped and dug her nails into his knee. He hoped he was making a decent hash of it. After a while, he tried telling her she was beautiful. Oh, the 10-foot-tall, horn-rimmed creature sighed out. I didn't know you were into humiliation. Yes, yes, do it harder. Decibel froze. But he tried. He always tried. All right. Yes, well, you're a dirty little brush slut, aren't you? What? No, I said humiliate me. Like before, insult me. Go on, say something really degrading. Tell me I'm a good person. Right. You're a beautiful, accomplished individual worthy of respect, aren't you? Nasuno shuddered violently from head to toe. She wasn't half as selfish as Gobo. The smaragdin leaped up and gave Decibel's hair a good seeing to. And though it didn't have quite the same effect on him, it was comforting and relaxing, and after an hour or so, just when he really started to think he could get into this in a more direct way, she stopped. Do you want to? She whispered, hardly daring to hope. I'll show you mine if you show me yours. The feelings bit. Yeah, you know me. Nothing's too wild. She collected her limbs onto the bed, careful not to jostle the snoring moonbeam, and the two of them sat cross-legged across from each other on the mattress. A rather medieval painting of a unicorn hung over the bed behind Nasuno's head. Her pale, bony frame blocked out the hunters and the virgin who were out for the poor pony's blood. You first, she encouraged him. Whatever you want, baby. Well, let's see. I'm pretty terrified, if you want to know the truth. I'd never tell Ort this, but I just wish they'd picked someone else. I wish I were someone else. Someone you could rely on to turn it out, no matter what. I'm afraid that whatever I had is lost by now. I haven't had a song out in years. I haven't had a good day in years. What if I get up there and just completely blow it? Or worse, what if I get up there and give the performance of my sorry life, the best show in the history of me, if the light of the world comes beaming out of me like a bloody Care Bear stare for the ages, and it's not good enough? If you lot somehow hear in my voice all the worst of us? Because there's a lot of worst. There really is. You only know what we've done since we invented radio. Before that, it gets really hairy. And I'm nobody's shining example. I'm not innocent. I'm all junked up inside, always have been. No musician isn't. That's why we're musicians. That's a bit of a flaw in your whole system, honestly. His voice started to tremble. All I've ever wanted is to be like that thing in the painting behind you. It's called a unicorn. It's not a real animal or anything. Back when we thought we were alone in the universe, We made up a lot of other intelligent creatures so we could have someone to talk to at night. Anyway, the thing about unicorns was that they were innocent. So innocent that you couldn't even lure one out of the forest except with a trick. It was too sweet and dumb to figure out. And even then, it still wouldn't dream of stabbing that bitch in the gut when the hunters came. It forgave. It kept on loving, even with a belt around its neck. But I've never been like that. Not even close. Ask Mira. Ask Ort. Hell, ask the Roadrunner. And I'm going to go on stage tomorrow, and even if I sing to shatter the heavens, you'll see how I really am. How we really are. Nasuna Oof looked over her shoulder at the rubbish hotel painting and gave a long, low whistle. I wish I had your confidence, she said. Now, don't make me wait for it. Show me your feelings. Jones narrowed his eyes. I just did. Honestly, I'm a little hurt. I just laid out my heart. What else do you want? The Smaragdin cocked her head to one side. Oh. Oh. Ooh. Was that it? Is that how primates externalize emotion? Do you really keep your feelings on the inside? Do you not? Nasuna Oof grinned. Then she stretched her lithe ribcage arching toward him. Her lips parted. Something emerged from her baroque breastbone. A spur of bone, the same color as the rest of her. Then more than a spur. It began to darken as the air hit it, as it squeezed out of her like toothpaste out of the strangest tube. Like I said, she panted. The old in-out. I've always felt sorry for people who are limited to verbalization. It's so easy to fake it. It didn't seem like a thing that should be happening. It didn't seem like a thing that should be possible. She was all bone and armor, unpierceable, impregnable. But her chest cavity might as well have been a butter sculpture at a county fair for all the resistance it gave. Smaragdy emotions leave mineral deposits in our organs as they pass through us. Strong feelings can overwhelm our filtering systems, build up too fast, at which point we have to pass them or we can suffer psychological toxicity and require dialysis or even a transplant. Do you have kidneys? Decibel Jones could not look away. It was obscene and clinical and intimate and performative all at the same time. Like watching an orgiastic tribal dance about lab results. Two of them, last I checked, he answered without blinking. It didn't seem to hurt her. She seemed to love every minute of it, in fact. Her breathing was quick, soft, ecstatic. Think of it as passing a kidney stone, if your kidneys were located in the pleasure center of your brain. Most of us do it once a day before bed. We have whole china cabinets full of stones. A perfectly, utterly honest record of every emotional state we experience. Symbolic representations formed in the collective unconscious. But you can't make them lie any more than you can make your kidneys pretend to be hearts. She pulled the rest of the feeling stone out with her fingertips and placed it in his hand with a shivery, delighted sigh. It was a child's toy. A small, charcoal silver figurine, still warm from her body. It was one of the unicorn hunters from the painting on the wall. As he held it, Decibel was overwhelmed with foreign emotions. Satisfaction, triumph, anticipation, relief, fear, crippling social pressure, artistic insecurity, ambition, xenophobia, and a strong, awful flood of schadenfreude. This was the Smaragdy climax, he realized. Eat your heart out, Dr. Kinsey. Jones wanted to shake it off and leave with some devastating quip, but he couldn't look away from the vicious little action figure. He couldn't move at all. The inundation of her feelings turned his synapses into a malfunctioning tech rehearsal for fight or flight, and he could not move at all. Nasuno Oof looked at him with the last dregs of pleasure in her eyes, and what appeared to be genuine regret. "Sorry, love," she crooned. "You know how it is. All's fair in the semi-finals. I really am sorry. I think humans are wonderful, so attractive and creative and musically talented, and obviously deeply sentient." She stroked his hair fondly. "It's the Alunazar, see? They're going bankrupt. Year after year, everyone votes them into oblivion because we're not allowed to get our war reparations any other way. Every year, they send 5-star catering to a galactic table and get back crumbs. Serves them right, if you ask me, but you can't expect them to just take total economic collapse on the chin. And since these tone-deaf space monsters would rather suck face with a colicky wormhole than award Aluno any points at all, well, our friendly local sea squirt hired me to take out some of the low-hanging fruit." The skeletal assassin shrugged sheepishly. "Now this is a bit barbaric, I admit. But galactic society is still, well, society. And society is rubbish. Good Lord, the Grand Prix is the best thing we've ever done, the utter best, and it's just a bit of song and dance, isn't it? I never did say we were good, just sentient. It's like Gogonar Gorkanon's 11th unkillable fact always says, you can't stop people being assholes. They do love it so. The best you can hope for is that some people, sometimes, will turn out to be somewhat less than the absolute worst. When they manage to trip and fall over that incredibly low bar, they'll make you want to end it all. But when they leap over it, they'll make you believe this whole mess really was created for a reason. The bastards. Except me, of course. I'm superb. Ask anyone. And you're all right, I suppose. Welcome to being a people kid. It's just dreadful up here." Nasuno Oof hopped off the bed and bent down close to his ear. Des sat transfixed by the silver hunter in his hand, still as a photograph. "You're a beautiful, accomplished species, worthy of respect," she purred in his ear. "And you, Decibel Jones, were the best I've ever had." Just as he regained control of his motor functions, the amorous Smaragdin picked up that massive, button-encrusted remote off the bedside table, aimed it directly at Decibel Jones's vocal cords, and pressed mute. "Are you really going to kill me with a Panasonic universal remote?" Jones tried to quip. Nothing came out. He groped at his throat, tried to sing a few bars of Ziggy Stardust. More than this, parsley, sage, rosemary and thyme. Happy fucking birthday. Anything. Nothing. "See you on stage," said Nasuno Oof. "Best of luck." When Ort St. Ultraviolet got back to their room, he found nobody there. No Decibel, no weird alien conquest, just a quiet suite with a mint on the pillow and their costumes folded neatly on the bed. Grown out of a bar on the other side of the galaxy, from seed bins with ridiculous labels like Love Wasted and Till We Meet Again and The Folly of Youth and The Bad Old Days and Peace at the End of All Things. On one end of the bed lay a dismembered lady's red sequin blazer, low slung, mercilessly tight trousers that had once been a wine-stained wedding gown, and a cricket jumper with the name George embroidered lovingly on the hem in purple thread with a jaunty bat on either side. On the other lay a pair of satin paisley trousers with vintage 80s gold accent chains all over them, platform boots, black plastic bat wings, and Robert, smelling just like roses. 31. Lullaby for a Volcano. Decibel Jones and the Absolute Zeros began and ended in nondescript rooms with not much more to recommend them but a couple of beds, a TV, a mini-fridge, and the reek of destiny. One was the kind of flat you could afford on what Mr. Five Star was willing to pay out. The other was a hotel in Scotland. Other people are frightfully useful and pleasant things, but not, strictly speaking, a must-have to get around town. Even the jankiest, hand-me-down, damaged-as-is human heart, one that couldn't pass a user safety inspection to save its own ventricles, can be the handcrafted, jewel-toned, durable, all-seasons high-end accessory before, during, and after the fact of life on planet Earth. Other people don't just get you from day to day. They get you there, despite all their irritating habits and unnecessary mannerisms, in comfort, good company, high style, full of canapes, with a good buzz going, and looking like somebody to reckon with. Which is very important to most young species trying to splash some cash around and make their mark on the nightlife. But you could always go it alone. You can try, anyway. Sometimes, even whole countries try. Listen, that small, watery, excitable planet is a pretty damnably woolly place, and we've got a lot to cover in a short time if we're going to get through the whole history of the Zeros. But try not to forget about those lonely countries. They're going to be important in a minute. In the early days of the band, it had been easy. They never wanted to be apart. Whether or not anyone else happened to be nearby was as consequential to the Absolute Zeros as what was on tap at any given pub on any given day at any given time. But there is a certain energy to cliché, a certain gravity, as inexorable as entropy, and from the same part of town. You can plan for it. You can set your watch by it. It has a beat, and you can dance to it. By the time Decibel Jones, Mira Wonderful Star, and Aught Saint Ultraviolet were huddled around a television in Edinburgh as if it were an ancient campfire, while Lila Poole paced back and forth, smoking Israeli cigarettes one after the other, they cared very much about whether anyone else was around, and what was on tap at the local on that particular night and that particular time. You can plan for the slow expansion and dissolution of the energy of the universe. There are equations and formulas to tell you what to pack for the trip and how much time you've got left. You can't plan for the sudden acceleration of heavenly bodies to intolerable velocities, or for their occasional screeching stop. But the shock of a hidden pocket of heat death roaring in the dark, ever so much closer than it ought to be. They watched it all happen on television, as though they were citizens of a much earlier generation. The revolution was always going to be televised. It wasn't the kind of revolution that would miss out on those ratings. They'd sung all night on stage, sung until they were dry of music, not knowing that they had already run face first into the cartoon Wile E. Coyote wall of the future. That deportations had begun. That cool Uncle Takumi had died in a riot, trampled underfoot by hundreds trying to pretend time hadn't run out. That they hadn't been pinwheeling their legs over a bridgeless chasm for some time now, still imagining they were walking on safe ground. That Nani was already in a processing facility, awaiting a flight to Islamabad, because Mr. Prime of the Minister said in a sad, carefully empathizing tone that she didn't have the right passport and had stolen enough resources for one lifetime. That no one had come to the show, not entirely because the Zeros were yesterday's hotness, but because they were home watching the world as they knew it end. For Aught and Des, it happened in Mira's eyes. Reflections of the news, backward and inverted. Chirons rolling across her unbelieving irises. They ate everything in the minibar mechanically, methodically, tasting nothing, saying nothing. In fact, no one said anything at all until Mira turned to her friend and whispered, "Marry me." And Decibel Jones laughed. Nervously, instinctively, afraid and thrown sideways, but a laugh all the same. If he hadn't laughed, she would have said the rest. She would have said it, and he would have understood. But he laughed, because it seemed like the most idiotic thing in the world. So he laughed, because how can you live when everything is lava on top of acid, on top of fascist cream pie? Let alone marry anyone or make the slightest plan that involves a future. He laughed in her face, and Mira Wonderful Star, hopped up on candy and crackers and shock, didn't have the right octane fuel for that. So she didn't finish. She just let it end with marry me, instead of marry me, marry me, Des, and we'll be safe. We'll be a nice straight couple with money in the bank, and no one can be offended by that. No one can come after that in the night. We'll be together, and we'll smile our best English blokeman smiles, and no one will be able to touch us. You were born here. I wasn't. Without you, I'm not safe. Aught has Justine. It's just us kittens left, and the rain is coming. Marry me, and we'll make a little bubble universe where nothing has to change, and the elections never happened, and it's just archival us, neon against the night, ice cream against the world. How could I know? Decibel would say to Aught 15 years later on a spaceship to nowhere. How could I know what she meant? Unfortunately, Decibel Jones's laugh blew Mira out of the sky. Aught was convinced that it was cruelty, and not terrified, confused hysteria born of Nani not answering her phone, not answering, still not answering. Why wasn't she answering? A band of glam rock gutter glitz punks took the end of the world on the chin. Each blamed the other, no one explained themselves, and Lila Poole quietly seethed about their refusal to stop messing about and discuss things like adults. Half of humanity was already steaming and scrambling against the other half by the time Decibel's father called him to tell him about Nani. Mira never did find out about her uncle. And the next 10 years progressed at record speed from confusion and posturing to, in technical terms, an intergalactic shit show. One way or another, the absolute zeros weren't really much for situational awareness, and never noticed Mira grab the keys to the van off the top of the refrigerator and slip out the door onto a much longer road than any of the rest of them could imagine. Heart. Forever and ever together, we sail into infinity, where higher and higher and higher, we're reaching for divinity. Euphoria, Loreen. 32. Every song is a cry for love. The 100th Metagalactic Grand Prix was held on Letost, the Claveret homeworld, on the ruins of Limu, where the war ended. It was the first Grand Prix in 21 years to feature a new applicant species, after all that unpleasantness with Fluce and Muntin. To all the gathered Lunazar and Keshet, Smaragdi and Elikon, Sieve and Vurpret, Lumatis and Slozhit, Esker and Asdir and Urshelas and Maleg and Yuz and Yurtmak and 321, and the single, solitary, remaining Inaki. It seemed somehow appropriate that the 100th anniversary gala should have real stakes, should prove the purpose of the Grand Prix all over again, should rock the goddamned house down. Doors opened at 7. The show started at 8. In pubs and clubs and house parties across the galaxy, the viewers at home were drunk by 6. The Mamtak aggregate and DJ Lights Out, beloved, though getting on in years, masters of ceremonies, sanctioned haters, and winners of the 2nd and 6th Grand Prix, floated and hobbled onto the stage of life, respectively. The Yuzosh beatboxer swirled into the shape of a massive disco ball and spun round for the delight of the crowds. The constant twilight of Letost glittered on the silicate beings, and the air smelled of roses and cocaine.
Welcome to the 100th Metagalactic Grand Prix!
Thundered the little Elik DJ Lights Out. The audience roared. The cheap seats stomped whatever they had in the way of feet.
It's probably going to be a bit shit, but it's better than another war, am I right?
in the dive bars and speakeasies and orbital bistros of the civilized galaxy, a blast of applause blew out windows, cracked tables, and short-circuited the mood lighting. In the bars, pubs, restaurants, hotel lobbies, airports, offices, and quiet, tense lounge rooms of Earth, no one thought the joke was particularly funny. The hypno-kelp dimmed. The crowds went quiet. The ocean of unconditional acceptance crashed against the shore, and the Grand Prix began. The Alunazar, as the prime political mover in the galaxy, were granted the first performance slot by the Grand Prix governing body, which meant that by the time voting started, no one would even remember the name of their song. Better Than You swept onto the stage in a rush of aquatic explosions and radical interpretive plopping. Slekka 5 and their four lumbering electric-veined gold bandmates slung the straps of their heat-seeking mandolins over what passed for their shoulders. They strummed the delicate fleshy strings with their nubs, while geysers of locally sourced eel-lit seawater detonated behind them, filling the stage of life with a melancholy, classical melody as heartfelt and skillful as any backwoods grandfather showing his boys what real music was. After about 45 seconds of that, Slekka 5 belted out a neuron-curdling war yodel, and the beat kicked in. "Is your continual mistreatment of our entire species fair trade?" would be heard in every convenience store and mall elevator on the settled worlds that summer. The Muzak version, anyway. But despite the truly self-righteous beat, the Grand Prix audience wouldn't give those overgrown painted goiters the satisfaction, not even during the final verse in which the Alunazar rockers removed their budded offspring, one by one by ruby-threaded one, letting them slide onto the stage like jeweled tears, and assembling a chorus of generations vibrating at a frequency only the cool could hear. The Mamtak aggregate formed itself into the shape of a lonely, overturned can of soup. DJ Lights Out nodded.
"Leave it to the Alunazar to try to make things political," she said, making sarcastic air quotes with her long, twiggy fingers. "Somebody cut their wamplifiers. My ears can't take the nub hurt."
Color drained from the faces of the 50 or so cops at a police bar in Birmingham.
"How is this not political?"
shouted the chief through the film of his fifth scotch. The Vourpret hitmakers' Vigor Mortis Overdrive cut in with a slamming drum riff. Puvinous Bleck, who had ditched its rapidly curdling Keshet body for a nearly fresh Slozit one, spread its rotting wings, lifted a ceremonial Gagaba shovel high into the dusky sky, and, accompanied by gouts of purple flame and guttural death metal vocals, smashed it against the stage, obliterating a cleverly concealed nest sack burst open beneath the floorboards and releasing a swarm of frenzied earworms into the stands like a comedian smashing a watermelon all over the front row. No one could get "No Antibody for Love" out of their heads as the infectious song spread from host to host and the euphoria secreting worms burrowed deep into various and sundry ocular organs to lay their eggs. The Mamtak aggregate coalesced into an old, droopy sock with holes in it.
"I thought it was great,"
enthused the Elec, her gigantic eyes shining.
"I got my vaccinations, didn't hear a thing."
The 3-2-1, no longer stored in the body of Clippy, but simply downloaded into a mixing board that bore more than a passing resemblance to Captain Nemo's organ, played their anthem of loss, hope, and the inability to escape the rainbow wheel of suffering and end the cycle of life, death, and the categorical oppression of synthetic life by gross, moist organics. Abort, retry, fail, without fanfare or effects, which put everyone right off from the start. The 3-2-1 had calculated it to be the perfect song, a precisely tuned slice of electro-pop confectionery that nevertheless spoke of deep, universal themes everyone could relate to, immaculate in every respect, from melody to rhythm to emotional effect. It went on to become the most refunded single in the history of the galactic musical economy, for reasons given variously as, you can't really dance to it, I think I'm going to go off music for a while, and it's hard to work out when you feel a deep sense of unease in the presence of gym equipment. Up next was the home team, the claveret sensation Hug Addiction. A holographic garden erupted over the stage, each hyperreal flower concealing a mister that pumped out a scent chemically formulated to lower the artistic standards of anyone within range. The Rose Topiaries performed a traditional dance of conflict resolution, vibrating their stamens into the memories of everyone who heard even a single note of their song, like a heart-seeking laser, finding, targeting, sampling, and remixing the songs that were playing when each person felt the most perfect love and acceptance in their lives, and mixing it down into what would go on to be the dance craze of the decade, I Wanna Be Elated. In a modest house outside Budapest, a woman heard her mother, her sisters, her daughters, and her child self all singing 1,000 Hungarian folk songs and old photo film commercial themes in such piercing harmony that she collapsed on the floor in a rictus of emotional cohesion. The lights went out, just as Once You Go Black got the crowd on its feet. They rocked out the Sagrada Way, and unless your eyes evolved in a world like a locked broom closet, you never saw their pyrotechnic dark show or their synchronized Sagradan tango. Dark Boy Zaraz played the dark matter didge so fine, the vibrations slid a cool black cosmic calm into every cell of every poor benighted light body, so that they could finally know some peace. Some peace called Black is the New Black. Decibel Jones and Aught Saint Ultraviolet watched it all from the wings. They watched the Uteruk thump out a thunderous rock anthem called Tell Me About Your Mother by hurling themselves against one another until the cracks and booms became a percussion and their cries of pain became a melody line, and the whole of Litost danced along. They watched the Eska infra-pop duo Birdwood let the sweet wind of the sea play over their chest cavities to the tune of You'll Feel What I Tell You and You'll Like It, and wash the stage in such bright light from their lamps that the afterimages sparkled emerald in everyone's vision for days. They watched the Sieve supergroup Us swathe the stage in their algae until seabirds came, and the song of the seabirds was the song of the sieve, until they ate the seabirds, and that was their song, too. They watched the Yurtmak punch the stage in the face and slaughter their Yelkor ballad, In the End We're Actually Kind of Sorry We Missed the War, You Guys Have All the Fun. They watched the soulful Nasuno Oof stand center stage with her violet eyes full of tears, singing, And I Am Telling You I Am Not Sentient, which brought the house to its knees and sobbing. And they watched Alabel, the friendless, swing up a long trumpet with his firefly-coated trunk and play the deepest blues of all time, until the strange elephant sank onto its stomach, singing the immortal chorus, I miss them all so much, I promise never to skip school again, I swear, just come back. It's so lonely being the last of us. The songs went on and on, beggaring the mind, the ear, the very definition of music. Until the end. New species go last. Decibel coughed. He looked pleadingly at Aught. Stage fright? His old friend asked, and he was not even a little bit teasing, as he felt certain the first musical note the civilized galaxy was going to hear out of humanity was him violently throwing up into a tuba. Don't worry. We got this. It's a good song, Des, I promise. Well, it's all right. Just do your best. Pretend everyone's not watching. Close your eyes if you have to. It's just us up there, us and Mira. Only her mic doesn't work, you know? Hey, Dinesh, Ought St. Ultraviolet put his hand on his old friend's cheek. It's all okay. I still love you. Always did. And he kissed him gently on the forehead, as if to make it true. Then once, briefly, warmly, and so arkably, on the lips. Dess gestured emphatically at his throat for the millionth time that day. He'd tried to find a pen. He'd tried to find paper. He'd tried scratching it into his arms in blood. But fingernails really don't do much of a job. Ort rolled his eyes impatiently. What is your problem? You've been acting so weird and quiet. Where were you all day? Are you mad at me? So I didn't spend all day spooning with you. I was out with friends for once. You should meet them. They're really something, the Elecon. I got here in time, didn't I? Decibel Jones tried again to claw, I can't sing, that tall bint stole my voice, into his forearm. Tears of frustration and real boiling fear welling up in his eyes. But Ort St. Ultraviolet was already half on stage. Fine. Be that way. Just do your thing and let's go home. I don't know why you always have to be so dramatic. It was time for Decibel Jones and the Absolute Zeros, or at least what was left of them, to save the world. 33. Tell me who you are. Decibel Jones and the Absolute Zeros went on just as the storm clouds began to gather over the stage of life. They had no gouts of flame. They had no bioluminescent burlesque. They had no teleportation or time travel technical effects. They had two people standing center stage in the dark. They had a microphone. They had something that looked like a glass house made out of a tuba. And they had a voice. Dess opened his mouth to sing for his life. Maybe whatever that walking pile of coat hangers had done to him would go away if he sang hard enough, if he blew out his capillaries, singing for all he was worth, which he knew in the end wasn't much. But if he could do anything, he could talk when he wasn't supposed to, sing when he was meant to be a good, quiet boy, seen and not heard. He'd been doing it since the day he was born. Maybe he could do it now. Maybe it would be enough. Ort started up the overture. He thumped the drums with his foot pedal and folded himself into the autophone. Music began to hit the speakers and flow out into the ears of too many people to think about. Perfect music. Every note a crystal. Decibel Jones took a breath. He took a breath to sing what they'd written in the reef ship. Their clever, clever plan, hiding behind all that poetry, all that human genius, so they never had to risk their own voices being the ones to damn a planet to silence. He'd blow out that stupid mute button with the sheer need to live, the need to matter. It would all be fine. He stepped up to the mic. All he sang was silence. He didn't come in on the downbeat. Or the upbeat. Or any beat. Decibel froze. Just like he had at the Hope and Ruin that long ago first day of all days. Just like that day in Nani's scarves. He was right back there, standing on that worn red rug, trying to sing along with Marvin the Martian, till his face felt like it was going to explode with the effort of making no sound at all. It was like he wasn't even there. Like he'd never existed in the first place. Like always. Like forever. What the fuck, Des? Hissed Ort. Sing, you bastard. What are you playing at? Decibel turned to his friend and pointed at his throat again. Tears streamed down his face. Sweat plastered his hair to his forehead. Christ, I'm trying. I'm trying so hard. Finally, Ort St. Ultraviolet got it. The lovely boom and trill of the autophone went silent as the realization went through him. We're all going to die. Des is broken, and we're all going to die. My girls are going to burn. What the fuck do I do? He tried to think of a song. Not their song, any song. A Zero song, a Bowie song, a nursery song, anything. But his terror-addled brain formally informed him that it had never heard a single song ever, and had no idea what music even was, so kindly leave it alone. My girls are going to burn. Sing something, Omar Chick. Sing anything. A solitary, clear, pure voice filled up the stadium on Litost. It trembled a little, but it was true. In front of God and aliens and everybody, Omar Jalushkin sang the only song he could think of. It came upon the midnight clear, that glorious song of old, from angels bending near the earth to touch their harps of gold. Peace on the earth, goodwill to men, from heaven's all-gracious King. The world in solemn stillness lay, to hear the angels sing. Still through the cloven skies they come, with peaceful wings unfurled, and still their heavenly music floats o'er the weary world. Above its sad and lowly plains they bend on hovering wing, and ever o'er its babel sounds the blessed angels sing. 34. Time is lonely. E and the Roadrunner watched from the Octave's posh jury box. Drinks and small plates of delightful foods littered the floor. Half the judges had gone to the toilets. The rest were discussing how marvelous I Wanna Be Elated had been, or whether to rank the Elecon above or below poor Alabel, who really did try his best without a backup band. It's not going well good, well, well, anywhere fast, E said, twisting his paws. Not even as well as I thought it would, agreed the Roadrunner, and I thought it would be a disaster. I could help, said the time-traveling Red Panda quietly. I could do the thing. I did a few runs-runs-goes-tries attempts during the semi-final. It'd be easy. It would be done-done-back-done before he's through with the second verse. You could. But it's cheating, E. Said Kloshar Avatar 9, enjoying a refreshing cocktail after her performance. They hadn't seen her standing there, but the jury box was littered with dormant Lumo stones, so any of them could turn up at any time. You had to be prepared for that with Lumatis. Minigame. Exciting. Not technically cheating, cheating, fudging, against the rules, cheating, cheating. And look, you only spent a few hours on Earth. I've been all over their timelines, timelines, quantum foam, possible forks, timelines. That's a lot of Decembers. I would do just about anything to make a Christmas carol stop. The tall blue ultramarine fish flamingo dropped her eyes to the floor. There is a process. We don't interfere. They have to do it on their own or not at all.
I thought you liked him.
I do, said the former lead singer of Bird's Eye Blue. He calls me the Roadrunner. That makes him the Coyote. How can you not love that stupid coyote?
Then I'll do, find, get, do, grab it.
Kloshar Avatar 9 said again, smacking her colourful lips. cheat code. Nice. You can't. It's against the rules. No one has ever helped another species before. Not even when the Ursula died mid-power ballad. We don't interfere. E thrashed his long, striped tail furiously. It's not interfering. The name on the list was Decibel Jones and the Absolute Zeros. All I'm doing is finishing your job. I'm getting the band to the venue, stage door, all in one piece. The Keshet grabbed two little toasts with creamed sunlight on top, crammed them in his mouth, stuck his tongue out at his avian friend, and vanished. Kloshar Avatar 9 stared after him with enormous cartoon eyes.
100 points, she whispered.
E was the first outsider to score in the grand game of the Lumitus, and, to date, the last. 35. It's all about you. Ort was nearly out of Christmas, and Decibel Jones was still trying to sing. He dropped to his knees, clinging to the mic stand in horror and gut-voiding terror of the totality of this failure above all his other failures. It shouldn't have gone like this. Maybe somewhere inside, he'd always known it would go like this without her. Without Mira to keep the beat out into the infinite future the way she always had. The way he thought she always would. His jaw ached from trying to birth the song horribly from the depths of him. He kept trying. He kept trying as people in the audience began to cough and look away in embarrassment. He kept trying as the sky grew darker and darker, and the voting officials began to noisily rummage backstage. He tried for Nani, and his brothers and sisters, and Mr. Looney of the Tunes, and the sold-out Hippodrome, and Dr. Collins, his psychiatrist, and Lila Poole, and poor Lost Mira, and that stupid badger, too. For Yoko Ono, and Revolution 9, and nice flats you couldn't afford, and kebabs you could, and short-haired white cats, and overly friendly waitresses named Ruby, and Alexander McQueen, and cool Uncle Takumi, and English bloke man, and government agents and thrift shop eyeshadow duos, and lions and rhinoceroses that were never coming back, and Mr. Five Stars Chip Shop, and Marvin the Martian, and the West Cornwall Pasty Company, and Acme Brand Instant Tunnels, and the Things of Thing World, and Arkable Gelato, and science fiction movies in which everything was simple, and very few musical numbers turned up, and even the bloody Daily Mail, all of it sacred, all of it real, all of it loved in that moment by those two souls 7,000 light-years away. But it was no good. He had nothing. He was nothing. He was invisible, voiceless, no one. Ort had very little left of It Came Upon a Midnight Clear, and the only person who seemed to be picking up what he was laying down was a short little Elec in the front row, clicking his fingers with his eyes closed. He tried again. It would work this time. These were his last seconds of existence. He wondered if they'd just incinerate him immediately, or ship him back to Earth for the big barbecue. He'd come so far to fail. Decibel Jones gave up. Fuck it all to hell. Goodbye, life. Goodbye, Earth. Goodbye, rosé wine. Goodbye, hope. Goodbye, ruin. My tail's unnailed for good. God, I miss you so much, Mira. His brutally muted vocal cords strained to say. I promise never to skip school again. Just come back. It's lonely being the last of us. I wish I could fix it all. I wish I could have been better. That's all. I just wish I was better. The storm overhead broke. Tiny diamonds rained down from the absurd skies of the happiest planet in the galaxy, where sentient civilization almost cannibalized itself
and burned its own bones to ash. The clouds were so unfathomably dark, beyond dark, into shades of the void. They swirled and pooled and yawned, sickeningly, the way the surf retreats before a tsunami hits. It's counterintuitive. It doesn't look like what it is, but it's a dead giveaway. Pulsating neon vortexes began to show through the clouds. Decibel felt something very wrong. The breath under the notes that would not come was stuck, pinned to his diaphragm, sawed in half over that awful, vicious heartburn he hadn't been able to shake since he'd left the planet. The air was seeping up out of his throat, all wrong, without the right power behind it, but with something else sucking at it. Something new. Something borrowed. Something with feathers. The breath burst free and flowed over the larynx of the glam rock glitterpunk messiah, bringing with it a small black and blue infant bird, with long escafrons and clever human eyes and a ribcage like a non-consensual feelings flute. Decibel Jones's love child lodged in his throat. It would have been no problem for an Esker. There would have been 14 of them, and they'd have flown out prettily through the gaps in his chest cavity and into the warm, welcoming light bath of their other parent. But thrill-seeking genes had to make do with available materials. There was only one baby, conceived in a garret in Croydon, gestated in a paradox-fueled reef ship, and born on Letost at the best part of a song that never was. And it was a breech birth. Decibel Jones collapsed in a heap of agony. His head fell beside the ghostly footlights as sinkholes appeared in the boiling clouds. His breath blew past the holes in his love child's ribcage. And a voice, not quite his, and not quite his baby's, burst out over the sea of dropped jaws. "Everything just gets so fucked up sometimes!" Decibel shriek-sobbed out a screamy bit to raise Yoko Ono from the grave and make her proud. And a tiny, brand-new creature hopped out of his mouth and nestled down in Robert's Baroque sleeve. A plaintive, desperate bird's cry went up from the back of the house as the roadrunner began to run in earnest, birthlight pouring from her lantern, trying to catch her baby in her grotto before it suffocated in shadows. A sound like someone belly-flopping onto a church organ and hitting every note at once shattered the air over what was once Vlamu. Incandescent, blue-violet mouths opened in the sky, a dozen of them, sucking at the sweet Letostian gravity, dragging up waves against the Colosseum, shearing pearly mountains into the ocean, that was no longer quite so into the idea of unconditional acceptance. Gaping holes punched in reality, hungry maws opening into the infinite guts of space-time. The wormholes had come to feast on the banquet of regret that was Decibel Jones and the absolute zeros. And now, the wormholes were singing. A tentative drumbeat tapped in somewhere in the depths of the stage. Decibel held out his finger for his kid to hop on. The roadrunner's light drenched them both. She was looking up in parental panic from the mosh pit. He looked from her back into the little bird with human eyes. Nani's eyes, actually. More Mr. Looney of the Tunes than Mr. Ridley of the Scot. "I'm gonna name you Marvin," Decibel said softly. And, to his shock, he actually said it. The trauma of delivery had seemingly broken whatever boot the Smaragdi and the Alunazar had put on his voice. Marvin whistled a little tune that felt like the Cathedral of Notre Dame when it hit Dessa's bones, all lit up and everywhere to go. It was so beautiful. His baby. It was unique in the history of the universe. It was just a hell of a thing. It didn't really matter, of course. They were all going to die. Everyone he'd ever known, and him too. They'd failed, and you couldn't unfail something just because you suddenly needed a spot of maternity leave. But at least this had happened first. Another tap of drumstick on drumskin. Wouldn't it have been nice to get a note in? Dess thought. Just one. Come on, a voice said softly from the direction of the drums. Up you get. Time to get that tail nailed back on. Decibel sighed. That was it, then. The Roadrunner had come with a big vaudeville hook to pull him off stage and collect her offspring. Using Mira's voice was poor form, though. There were limits. The voice changed abruptly. Oh, get up, Dinesh, you lazy wanker! Aught Saint Ultraviolet turned to look. His blood attempted to escape his body by leaping a foot to the left. But he was faster than a well-regulated public health system, more powerful than the need for tea at 3 in the afternoon. He was English Bloke Man, and English Bloke Man did not shirk. He shimmied into his autophone before his brain could start questioning everything that was happening and spraying antibacterial gel all over it. He got in and watched a dead girl with cheeks as bright as the future count off the beat. She saved them. The last of many times, Mira Wonderful Star, lately of the London underground scene, her uncle's flat, and a timeline plundered by a well-meaning red panda who had cornered her after their last show in a shitty club and told her her friends were waiting for her. The last show when everything had gone perfectly, when everything was roses and the air was as good as cocaine, when the future was dry of all possible tears. Mira Wonderful Star, reeling from her first hit single off Space Crumpet, Apocalyptic Girl Spill No. 4, damaged, as is, clad in a spandex, slutty C-3PO costume, silver brocade Christmas tree skirt, a gauzy black shower curtain with metallic blue applique roses all over it, and blissful ignorance of all that was to come, banged out a riff on her drums behind him, leaned into her mic, and yelled into the sold-out arena, loud enough to blow a dart from 1 to 20, loud enough to stun Arthur Archibald Gormley sober. "We are Decibel Jones and the Absolute Zeros!" she screamed over the pituitary-melting harmonies of the wormhole chorus above. "Mushy, mushy, wonderful," whispered Decibel Jones in utter and religious awe, just before the Roadrunner's undersea birth beams poured out over the stage and his skin and their child like the most glorious spotlight in the world. "Moshi moshi, Des," said a living, breathing paradox, and the resurrected Queen of Glam. "Everything just gets so fucked up sometimes," was the song of the century, and it barely even had any lyrics. Just full-throated, shimmering, babbling music, and the title, and a bit of Christmas carol, repeated over and over until the words lost all meaning, in dozens of combinations and several keys, and a handful of languages dredged out of primary school lessons buried deep in the subconscious. Decibel Jones and the Absolute Zeros finally had the Christmas pop single that year. The newborn and the dead, and the long-suffering and the extremely well-travelled. The baby and the girl and the boys in the band and the wormholes, all of them singing the screamy bit like a song could save the world, roaring like lions and squawking like dodos and thundering like rhinoceroses and weeping like a man who died with a final mix in his hands and dancing like a kid wearing 100 scarves and howling like an interdimensional wind tunnel of regret, belting it out with your future gurgling in your arms like sentient, human, goddamned beings. The arena was silent. Then the cheers began.
Well,
said DJ Lights Out after it died down,
I guess that was all right.
The Mamtak aggregate could not, just yet, form itself into anything at all. It lay in glittering pieces across the jury's couches, enraptured and inconsolable. 36. They can't stop the spring. Once upon a time, on a small, watery, excitable planet called Earth, a soft, rather nice-looking dawn broke over the sea and the green land. It was a usual sort of thing, the dawn. Yellow and quiet and uneventful. Soon there would be movement and sound and the rhythms of sentient life galloping along its absurd way, shaking its head to a new beat. Until next year. Two little girls in Cardiff woke to a kind voice and a kiss on the forehead. Daddy's home, darlings. And he's brought your kitty back all safe and sound. I think Capo should live with you from now on, don't you, Poppets? An old grandmother in government housing in Kabul woke to see her grandson's face, 50 feet tall, all over again, on every screen in the world. Point to Nani. A Klavar on Litost woke to see a young woman with hair like an oil slick, an Esker and a man in an absolutely splendid coat, laughing on the beach, leaping up like they were dancing, trying to touch the wings of a tiny, brilliant blue bird with long-lashed human eyes flying just out of their reach. A red panda waited just down the shore, wondering how to break the news about the necessity of containing volatile entities removed from their timelines. He fretted. Perhaps the girl would like being a paradox box. Just her existence was paradox enough to feel something truly tricked out. State of the art. He would furnish her box in style. Maybe she could even write a new album in there, if he made the thing really grand. Being a massively powerful ship sailing the infinite deep was better than being dead, anyway. Perhaps Decibel would be interested in a career in captaining starships. All things were possible. A large golden sea squirt woke to the censure of its government, which never looked kindly on big, fat failures. Despite the judgment of the jury being that the wormholes had placed third to last in the Grand Prix, and therefore now possessed the rights and privileges of galactic citizens, most of the great, infinite, gorgeous beasts just drifted off into the long light years in search of more food. One stayed. The Claveret named it Darling. And a man named Arthur Archibald Gormley walked out of the doors of the Hope and Ruin pub, out of the deafening noise of policemen and teachers and electricians and computer programmers and homemakers and children and accountants, out of the cacophony of their cheering and crying, hugging and swearing, and singing old football songs because they sounded like happiness, like being alive and drunk, and possibly, just for a little while, quite all right. Out of the crowd and outside, in the middle of the night, laid down on the sparse, brightened grass, and kissed it for everything he was worth. Life is beautiful, and life is stupid. As long as you keep that in mind, and never give more weight to one than the other, the history of the galaxy, the history of a planet, the history of a person, is a simple tune with lyrics flashed on screen and a helpful, friendly, bouncing disco ball of glittering, occasionally peaceful light to help you follow along. Cue the music, cue the dancers, cue tomorrow. This has been a High Bridge production, read by Heath Miller. Copyright 2018 by Catherine M. Valenti. Published by arrangement with the Howard Moorheim Literary Agency, Incorporated. Recording copyright 2018 by High Bridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.